Hey, welcome to Your Turn with Mike Causey, and I'm glad to have you here. And I can say that with confidence because I am Mike Causey. My guest this morning is Arthur Stein. He is an investment manager based in Bethesda, Maryland, and a lot of his clients are federal and postal workers and retirees, I guess of all grades, ages, stages of
all
development.
All of the above. Yeah, absolutely, okay. Mike.
And this is a big deal. The Federal Thrift Savings Plan, Uncle Sam's 401k plan, is it's the 800-pound gorilla in every room. It's the biggest of the big, isn't it?
Yeah, my understanding is it is probably the largest 401k plan.
Yeah, it's $436.8 billion. Billion with a B, according to Kim Weaver, Director of External Affairs. That's a lot of money, $436 billion. The average account balance for people under the old civil service retirement system, and these are the people that get the better annuity, but they don't get the contribution break from the government. The average account balance for the CSRS holders is $114,000. The average account balance for the FERS employees, which is the vast majority of people, those hired since the mid-1980s, is $113,000. So they're almost identical. And yet, obviously, looking at the retirement plans, you see that there, I would think there should be a slightly different investment strategy for the CSRS people versus the FERS people. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mike, that's absolutely true. And the reason is that with the older plan, the CSRS, many people retired with pensions that were 60, 70, up to 80% of their high three salary and could easily, you know, depending upon their personal situation, many of those people could easily live on that for the rest of their lives without really needing money from their investments. And of course, one of the reasons that might be true for them is that they have a full cost of living adjustment. With FERS employees, their pensions are going to be about half of what CSRS is. Now, they also get Social Security.
But it's not as generous as the
It's federal. Nowhere near as generous in terms of the pension, which the federal government calls an annuity. And the cost of living adjustment for the annuity is not as good. You could end up, like if inflation is 3%, the cost of living adjustment on a FERS pension is only going to be 2%.
Yeah. Diet Cola, they call it.
Yeah, Social Security has a full cost of living adjustment. But as a result, just as a generalization, I think that most people who retire under FERS at some point in their life are going to need to start making withdrawals from their investments to live on, to supplement their pensions and Social Security. And it means they have to be much more careful about building up a larger amount of money and making sure the purchasing power of that money grows over time. So I was surprised that the current balances are about the same. Of course, I don't know that the population is the same. Maybe the FERS employees we're looking at, probably younger than the CSRS employees. Could be a lot of reasons. But I would say this, the TSP is critical to FERS employees. They have to have that investment money to be comfortable and secure in their retirement.
And the TSP, again, I would think is also critical to military personnel, because even though they don't get the 5% match, they may someday, but they don't get any match now. But that's a pretty transitory business. Most people who join the military don't retire from it, just as most people who join the federal government don't retire from it. It's about a third. But they really need it, because that money then is portable when they leave the service and go out into the civilian
world.
Yeah,
absolutely. And, of course, that's the advantage of a TSP 401k program compared to a fixed annuity, a guaranteed pension, is that if you're not spending your whole life with the federal government, you build up those funds in an investment, and you can take all those dollars with you when you go somewhere else.
But the inspiration for today's show and today's column, and actually tomorrow's column, my federal report, is I found some old columns that you and I had done in October of 2007 and October of 2008. And what a difference a year makes. The 2007 people had pumped, was it said, a record $6 billion into their TSP from the end of August to the end of September, $6 billion in one. And this was right before the Great Recession hit and people knew it. The very next year, you and I talked about it, and I think we did a radio show then, but in the column talking about how people were fleeing the stock funds, the CS and I funds, and going into the super safe G fund. And while it's often said the G fund never has a bad day, it also rarely has a very good day as far as its returns go.
Yeah, and this is a huge concern with people handling their own investments and not getting advice from some kind of financial planner, investment managers. People tend to react emotionally. They tend to buy when the market's gone up a lot and they get enthusiastic, and then they tend to sell after it's gone down and they get discouraged. And because they're constantly buying high and selling low, they're not really doing very well. And the period you cite is a good example. I actually ran some numbers myself. And if someone was smart enough to switch out of the C fund at the very peak of the market and put it all in the G fund, so they completely missed the decline, that was in October of 2007 when the market peaked. So if you sold out the C fund then and put the money in the G fund was up 120% since then. But if you'd left the money in the C fund was up 155% over the same period. So if you did nothing, even at the peak of the market, you still ended up with more money than if you had, you know, switched out of the market and called yourself a genius and put it all in the G fund.
Well, the other thing, too, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, you switch out of the C fund and it's maybe doing well, it may be doing badly. You go into the G fund, and then every 2 weeks, you're buying more shares with the with your contribution and the government contribution, if there is one. But you're buying the G fund, which is what, not so good?
To me, it makes no sense to do a biweekly investment in the G fund. And you're putting in a small amount of money every 2 weeks over a long period of time. You know, why not put it in the F fund and the C and the S and the I fund? The market goes down while you're investing. That's a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
It's on sale.
And, you know, keep in mind that the allocation of your current investments, the money you already have in the TSP, does not have to be the same as the allocation for your biweekly investments. So yeah, when I get people who are very nervous and have switched all their money to the G fund and are very nervous about getting back in, one suggestion that I do make to them, well, at least for the new money, put that in the F and the C and the S and the I funds. And, you know, then you're looking forward to the market
going down. And hope the market
down.
Is down. Yeah, then it's on sale.
It's good for you at that point because you're buying. Now, it's different. If you're getting ready to retire, then you have a completely different set of issues.
Yeah. Well, I need to take a short break here. Lauren Larson, our producer, is giving me the hook. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM.
New civilian federal employees have the opportunity to automatically enroll for up to $100,000 of group term life insurance without answering a single medical question. This coverage is available through WAPA, a nonprofit association formed in 1943, whose mission is to provide for the health, welfare, and financial well-being of civilian federal employees and their families. To be eligible, you must be an active WAPA member, a newly hired civilian federal employee, enroll within 365 days of your federal hire date, and be a citizen of the United States under the age of 65. To learn more, visit waepa.org, where you can view the plan's details and electronically complete and submit the online enrollment form. To learn all the details about this open enrollment opportunity for newly hired civilian federal employees, visit waepa.org. That's waepa.org.
The WAPA Group Term Life Program is not endorsed by the federal government. Coverage is provided by Life Insurance Company of North America and is subject to insurer approval with evidence of good health. This policy contains exclusions and benefits and may reduce by age.
And now, the new IP for federal IT. Here's Anthony Robbins, VP of Brocade Federal, on the new IP.
The new IP for federal IT, what is it and why do we need it?
Today, in the environment we're living in, the megatrends that are driving the marketplace today, social, mobile, BYOD, data center consolidation, and on and on and on, cloud, obviously, require traffic to flow in a different manner across the network enterprise. So as a result of that, you know, we've got to build a new network infrastructure to serve the enterprise of tomorrow. And that's where this comes from.
How do you break the network status quo and begin your path to the new IP? Attend the 4th Annual Federal Forum 2015, presented by Brocade and FedScoop. Think big at the Federal Forum, June 17th at the Renaissance Hotel, downtown D.C. Start now. Register at federalforum2015.com. That's federalforum2015.com.
Join keynote speaker former FBI Director Robert Mueller, along with more than 1,000 government IT leaders, April 15th at the Symantec Government Symposium in Washington, D.C., to discuss the most pressing cybersecurity and information management issues today, including risk management, insider threats, cybercrime, policy updates, and much more. Register today at Symantec.com/symposium. That's Symantec.com/symposium.
Please join the Armed Forces Communications and Electronics Association, Washington, D.C. chapter, March 16, 2015, in Arlington, Virginia, to hear the latest information on where the Air Force is headed in cyber. The panel, moderated by Brigadier General Sarah Zabel, will discuss the major issues and challenges facing the staff and some of the programs that are being developed to address those issues and satisfy Air Force cyber requirements. To reserve your seat today, visit dcfciachapters.org.
Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Arthur Stein. He is an investment planner based in Bethesda. And as I said at the top of the show, he has a lot of clients who are current and former federal workers, postal employees, military personnel, and most of them have a stake in the Thrift Savings Plan. That's Uncle Sam's in-house 401k plan, and it is the biggest of the lot. It is worth $436.8 billion currently. That's billion with a B. The average account balance for the older employees, the longtime feds under the CSRS program, is $114,000 and change. The average balance for the newer employees, newer being people hired since the mid-1980s, is $113,000 and change. So very close. And as you were pointing out at the top of the show, the FERS employees, because they will get a smaller annuity, a smaller pension, and they'll be getting Social Security, but that's not as good as the federal program. And because they're on a diet cost of living adjustment system, diet COLAs, that they need to be more adventuresome and invest
and
more
aggressive. And they need to be building up a much larger amount of investments before they retire, because they're much more likely to need that money to live on.
Right. Okay. And the other thing, the magic thing about all this is that the FERS employees are entitled to a matching government contribution of up to 5%, which is it's a tax deferred pay raise.
And it's, you know, if you're putting in 5%, the government's putting in 5%.
Yeah.
I mean, the 10% of your salary is going in every year, and
that's huge.
It would be interesting, and we should do it at a later show, to look at the difference in the allocation between the FERS and the CSRS employees. I wonder if there's a difference.
I hope
there.
Kim Weaver is listening, and she'll be prepared.
Please, we need you now.
Kim is our savior in all these statistics. I have two friends, two coffee buddies, and one is currently in the construction business, has a very large, very prosperous, high-end construction company in the Washington area, and the other had a machine tool building operation, they made machine tools, in precision work, and both of them said that they tried very hard to get their employees to go into their own 401k plan, and they offer them a fairly generous match, 3-4%, but you know, it's a lot for the private sector. No takers. None.
Yeah, and that's just very scary. And, you know, the average American is retiring with Social Security and I think less than $100,000 in savings. And I just don't know how they're going to make it. Federal employees have been traditionally doing a much better job of planning for retirement. And you know, I applaud them for that.
Yeah. Well, and they also too, they're lucky. They don't like to hear it, but they're lucky in that the government will hire different companies to come in and do pre-retirement seminars for people. Many of them do it when somebody's 5 years out or when they're first eligible to retire, and extremely helpful to people. Bring in your spouse or significant other, listen to these things. I've had several people say they're teaching these seminars, and for the first time, people will realize they have a pension. They
didn't know
that.
I know.
You know, here we are, outsiders, the unwashed, but we know. Got a question here, if I can find it. Efron and...
I sort of remember his question.
Do you? Okay, I can clean off my desk. Here it is. Okay. Question for the show. It's easy to say stay the course. The market was close to an all-time high, and interest will be going up soon. Doesn't an individual's risk tolerance play a part in how much money is in equities? Good question.
Yeah, absolutely. Equities are stocks, and a key decision that people have to make, or their investment manager has to make, help them make, is what percentage of your investments are going to be in stocks and what percentage is going to be in bonds. With the TSP, it means what percentage is going to be in the stock funds, which is the C, S, and I funds. What percentage in the bond fund, which is the F fund, and what percentage in the G fund, which is like a savings account with a much higher interest rate than a normal savings account would have. Historically, over long periods of time, and past performance, no guarantee of future performance, but historically, people who had a higher percentage in stocks over long periods of time ended up with a greater growth in their investments. And it's because historically stocks had a higher rate of return. Not every year, not every 5 years, but over longer periods of time. You know, people have to decide whether they think that's going to completely change. And in the future, you know, stocks aren't going to do as well as bonds. One of the things people will hear is that because stocks have done so well, the future returns are going to be lower than the historical returns, which may be true. But the key question is, are stocks going to outperform bonds? And no one thinks that bond returns are going to be great in the future either, because bond prices are very high.
Well, if you do a stay the course kind of thing and buy low, sell high, the Depression, 1929 to arguably 39, or when we got in the war, but a long period of depression there, that was a buying opportunity if you had the guts.
If you had the guts,
yeah,
and a job.
And the
money.
Yeah.
But federal employees do. But I would say this, Mike. I mean, people have to be ready for stock market and bond market declines. And we are overdue for a major market, stock market decline, you know, 20% or more. Normally, we have one about every 3 years. We haven't had one for 6 years. So, you know, it would not be surprising if the C fund and, you know, the S fund were down 20% this year or next year or some point in the future. And, you know, if you're not ready for that emotionally,
mm-hmm.
well, then you have to, you know, have a cheaper standard of living, or be putting in a higher percentage of your income, or some way you have to make up for
that. Be prepared to work longer, maybe.
Be prepared to work longer, something like that. To me, it's like, you know, if the stock market goes down, maybe you should just ignore it and go about with your life and continue investing if you're a long way from retirement. Now, if you're already retired, you're in a different situation. You have to say, well, when am I going to start needing money and how long am I going to be needing it for? But don't kid yourself. I mean, the current bull market, and a bull market is when stocks go up over time. The current bull market in U.S. stocks is 6 years old. The average bull market since the Second World War is 5 years. So this is an above average run. Now, the longest bull market was about 10 years. So, you know, we're a long way from the longest. But still, be ready for a stock market decline. But if you're an employee, you're working, you're investing every 2 weeks, hey, when it happens, just ignore it. And if it does happen and you do have a lot of money in the G fund, you know, think about the fact that you might be a good time to switch some money from the G fund to the CNES fund.
Then you would be buying low.
Then you would be buying low. Also, keep in mind that the bonds are very high, which means that the F fund, which is a fixed income fund, it invests in bonds. We could see a decline there. Now, we saw a 2% decline in 2013, you know, over the calendar year. We could see that again. It could be more than 2%.
Okay. Now, the L funds, the life cycle funds, very carefully set up, and these are sort of fire and forget automatic pilot investing, and there's something called a present income, which means you're about ready to retire or you're retired. Then there's an L, I think, 2020 for the year 2020, 2030, 2040, and maybe 2050. I don't know.
There is a 2050. There is,
okay. So you look at, if you're real young, you say, well, I'll get in the 2050. That's the furthest out. That's the most aggressive because it has a larger mix of stocks, the CS and I funds. And it gets more conservative as time goes on until you get down to the present income fund, which is by many standards very conservative. There is money in the G fund. But you're not a big fan of life cycle funds.
Well, the life cycle funds, you know, the basic reason, the theory behind them is that when people are retired, they should have a very low percentage of their investments in stocks and a very high percentage in bonds. So the L income fund, which is what everybody ends up with, is 72% in the G fund and 8% in the F fund for a total of 80%, and then 20% in stocks. And that is definitely going to minimize the volatility, although it will not eliminate the volatility, but you know, it's going to minimize declines if the stock market goes down, but it's unlikely to increase your purchasing power over time. And, you know, when I deal with my clients, one of the things we have to take into account is we want purchasing power to increase. And the purchasing power of the G fund does not increase over time. And as a matter of fact, the return on the G fund has been declining, you know, for 7-8 years. And, even if the interest rate on the G fund was the same, prices go up, the interest is the same, so the purchasing power of the interest on the G fund goes down every year that there's a positive rate of inflation. Well, with the L income fund, you've got 72% of your investments in the G fund, and that's losing purchasing power. I mean, how many people can actually afford that?
Would one way to do it, I know several people that have done this, in fact, say you're by rights, I should be in the 2020 fund because that might be my retirement date or close to it. But I want to be more aggressive, as you said, and have more. So what if I went into the 2050?
You could do that. Mm-hmm. You could also just say, you know, I think I should have a certain percentage in the C and the S mm-hmm. and the I and a certain percentage.
Just do it yourself.
Yeah. And just do it yourself. It's so easy to do with the TSP. And that way you control it. And keep in mind, many people are retiring when they're 60, 65, and they could easily have a 30-year retirement. And the money that you need to spend 20 and 30 years from now, if you've left it in the G fund, or most of it in the G and the F fund, it's not going to be worth much when you need it 20 or 30 years from now.
I was looking at an obituary the other day, and someone had been retired for, I think, 44 years.
Yeah.
Right? Who knew?
Well, you know, think about it. I mean, if you retire at 60,
yeah,
lots of us are going to live to 100. I mean, medical care is great at keeping us alive. And we've got all these replacement parts. I love hearing about them. Mm-hmm. Now I read that, you know, we're going to have 3D printers to make body parts. So I guess I can do this work at
yeah.
home. And we're going to live a long time. And the ones, or at least we need to plan to live a long time so that we don't yeah. run out of money while we're alive. And this is an issue that's key, once again, for FERS employees. Again, you know, CSRS, if you retire with 80% and move to, you know, Florida, a much cheaper place, I mean, you may not ever need to think about taking money out of your investments. FERS, I don't think that's going to happen to many FERS employees.
Well, buying low and selling high, it seems to me it's easy. You wait until the market is low, and then you buy, and then when it's high, you sell. The problem, the hitch is, when is it high and when is it low?
Yeah.
You know, in hindsight.
And with the market, you know, what seems high today, you know, 10 or 20 years from now is going to seem low. So even if you're buying at the peak of the market, and, I just did that example. I mean, if you bought the C fund at the absolute peak in 2009, you still would have seen 155% appreciation between the peak and where it was at the end of last year. More than if you put the money in the G fund at the peak. I mean, the great thing historically about the stock market is you didn't need to buy and sell at the right times. You needed to buy and hold for an appropriate period of time. And then no matter when you purchased, you would have seen increases in your investments. You know, assuming you're in a well-diversified portfolio and you waited, you know, long enough for this to happen. It's not like, you know, investing in commodities or gold or something like that, where you have to buy and sell at the right time. That's what I consider to be a speculative investment. If you buy and sell at the right time, you can make money or lose money.
Gambling is another word for it, I guess.
Stocks are not gambling. Stocks are just, you know, if you wait long enough, you will be rewarded.
Yeah. Okay. I have two friends. A woman who had been an official in the Clinton administration, left, went into industry, made big bucks. Then when President Obama was elected, she decided to come back in the government to get the retirement and get the TSP and all that. A very smart lady, a very financially well off. She, in 2008, she said, I can't sleep at night. I got to get out of the stocks. So she went into the G fund almost exclusively. I haven't talked to her lately, but I assume she's still in the G fund. I have a friend who's a very good investor, and he's really watched his money over the years. He went out, I think, in 2007 or 2008 into the G fund, but he's never gone back.
And that's why he thinks he's a good investor, Mike, but I don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he went out before the crash and he went back in during the crash, then I'd say he was, you know, an excellent investor, way to go. But he didn't.
Yeah.
You know, he did what, and I've never really met anyone who did anything different. Even if they went out before the crash, they never got back in. And he was just real. He wouldn't say it, but he was just as fearful as the other person admitted that she was. He got scared. And that's why, you know, if you just hold, you don't have to do anything.
I saw a thing. I think it was we need a break. Yeah, we need to take a break here. We'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM.
Here's Roberto Guerrero, Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Energy, on Agency of the Month, sponsored by Martin Baker.
We made an effort when we saw these renewable alternative fuels being generated that we wanted to ensure that when those fuels are cost competitive with the standard petroleum fuels that we use right now, that we were able to use them on our aircraft. So we went through two different types of processes and certified those two different types of processes on all our aircraft.
To hear the entire show, go to Federal News Radio. Radio.com.
Thousands of feet above the earth at extraordinary speeds, our warfighters risk all for our freedom. To keep them safe, Martin Baker provides the most advanced modular structured ejection seat in the world, and to date has saved almost 3,500 American lives. Testing beyond what's required, pushing beyond existing limits, all for the sole purpose of keeping our air crews safe. Martin Baker, saving lives is our life's work.
I'd like to get some info on your credit cards, please.
Mumbo jumbo, mumbo mumbo jumbo, yada yada yada, disclaimer, fee fee fee.
Excuse me?
Blah blah blah, boo boo boo, beep beep beep.
Want a straight answer? Welcome to State Department Federal Credit Union. Get an SDFCU EMV Visa Platinum card with rates as low as 6.99% APR, plenty of rewards, and no balance transfer fees. Go to sdfcu.org. State Department Federal Credit Union. Straight answers. Happy banking.
APR equals annual percentage rate, rate based upon evaluation of applicants' credit, federally insured by NCUA.
At any given moment, somewhere in America, a baby is taking a first step, a developmental milestone. But for too many parents, a baby's first steps aren't just a milestone, they're a miracle. These are the parents of babies who were born prematurely or with birth defects. It's a crisis affecting more than 500,000 babies in the United States each year. You can help them by joining volunteers like you who walk in March for Babies. The money you raise funds research and local programs that help babies overcome the challenges of premature birth and birth defects. Together, our steps make stronger, healthier babies a reality for thousands of families. Sign up today at marchforbabies.org to take the steps that help make milestones and even miracles possible. Who will you march for?
The Vencor name might be new, but the company has over 40 years of proven performance in systems engineering, smart analytics, cybersecurity, and applied research. Find out more at vencor.com/WFED.
Newsmakers on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
Phil Null is fleet manager of the U.S. Postal Service.
We'll be looking for better ergonomics, safety features, fuel efficiencies, low emissions, better design flexibility, added space for packages, of course, because, we've had an extreme increase in package delivery. And we also are looking for minimized maintenance requirements. We also surveyed our employees to see what they would like.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Arthur Stein. He's an investment planner, manager based in Bethesda. Art, how can people reach you? Is there a...
They can get on my website, which is www.arthursteinfinancial.com, A-R-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-I-N, financial.com. And they can email me at art@arthursteinfinancial.com. If they get on my website, I have a blog where I, write various articles. There are also links to interviews I've done with Mike and Tom Temin. And if you want to be on my email list where I send out, notice if I wrote a blog and I have a monthly newsletter, you can email me and I'll put you on my email list and be happy to do it. And there's no salesy stuff going on with the email list.
No salesman will show up at the door, huh?
No.
Okay, one last question because we're going to go to Andy Medici at Federal Times here, but kind of a basic child's question. Unemployment's not all that good. Many of the jobs that are being created that they tout are not really high-paying jobs. They're not manufacturing. They're service and that sort of thing. Russia is taking bites out of Ukraine. The situation in Greece is iffy at best. Some other countries are talking about default. I think they said in one of the countries in Africa, there's 100% inflation rate. So why is the stock market doing so well?
Well, Mike, what drives the stock market over long periods of time is mainly corporate earnings, earnings per share. There are lots of different ways to measure earnings. But the more these companies make, it drives up the value of their stock. Now, on a short-term basis, people don't really know what drives the market up and down on a short-term basis. I mean, people will say it's this, that, but we don't really know. But it's earnings, and earnings have been great. Actually, earnings per share for U.S. corporations are at an all-time high. They've increased tremendously since the market crash, and that's what's driving the stock market up. And keep in mind that American corporations can do well even if American workers are not doing well. I mean, there is a disconnect. And so the unemployment rate is not as low as we'd like it to be. A lot of, as you said, a lot of the new jobs are lower paying than the jobs that were lost. A lot of people are not doing well, but corporations are doing well. Their earnings are up. The short-term fluctuations in the market, Alan Sloan had an excellent article in the Washington Post on January 9th, and he spoke about a four-day period, I think it was the previous week, where the market was down 2.5% over a two-day period, which for the total U.S. stock market meant it lost about $700 billion in value. And over the next 2 days, it went back up enough so that it gained back that entire $700 billion. And so what Sloan asked was, if there's a reason that it went down, did that really change in 2 days?
Mm-hmm.
Because when it was going down, you
probably
could read all
not.
Kinds of articles, people saying this caused it to go down and that caused it to go down. Well, did those factors go away? No, it's just the market fluctuates. It's the commonly called a random walk.
Yeah, the 24/7 news cycle requires people to comment.
To comment intelligently, and you know they're basically making stuff up.
Intelligently, not necessarily accurately.
Exactly.
Hey, thank you, Arston. I really appreciate it, and we'll be doing this again. Very educational. We'll take a short break here, and then we'll come back talking with Andy Medici of the Federal Times.
Do you want this?
And now the business of cloud with Vion Corporation, powered by Hitachi Data Systems Federal. Here's Steve Pico, VP of Federal Sales for Vion on IT consumption with cloud.
We're offering IT in a different way, IT by the drink, if you will. So I think their paradigm when they talk about budgets being flat is based on the history of large capital acquisitions. You know, no one buys more depreciating assets than the U.S. government. And change the mentality, change the approach, force people to bring you the right technologies in a different way, in a different vehicle, a different consumption model. And the organizations that are able to adapt and deliver that will be successful, and the other ones will become dinosaurs, essentially.
For over three decades, Vion has offered secure compute, network, and storage capabilities delivered on-premise or through the cloud. Let Vion give you cloud confidence and help your agency design, implement, and support a flexible solution that meets the needs and priorities of your agency. To hear more of this interview, go to federalnewsradio.com, search Business Cloud, or learn more at vion.com/cloud.
Why pay 19% credit card interest on money when you can refinance your mortgage, pay off your car note, credit cards, and student loans into a very low interest rate? Save money every month and improve your bottom line. Call New American Funding at 800-827-RATE, 800-827-7283.
Not licensed to lend in Washington, D.C., NMLS 6606, licensed by the State of Maryland Commissioner of Financial Regulations, license number 13245, licensed by the Virginia State Corporation Commission Bureau of Financial Institutions, license number MC3638. Terms and conditions subject to change without notice. Equal housing lender.
Eagles fans, be part of the excitement as AU men's basketball continues its quest for a repeat berth to the NCAA tourney as they take on the Lafayette Leopards this Wednesday, March 11th, 7 p.m. in the Patriot League championship game from Easton, PA. Catch all the live action on Federal News Radio, 10:50 a.m. That's AU men's basketball in the Patriot League championship with the NCAA tourney bid on the line. Wednesday at 7:15 on Federal News Radio, 10:50 a.m. Go Eagles!
Ball Aerospace has reimagined our universe with leading-edge space-based systems for nearly six decades. They've built seven instruments for the Hubble Space Telescope, capturing unmatched images that answer scientific questions, and enriched more than 40 years of global land observations by building the nation's newest operational land imager. Earth, Mars, Pluto, and beyond. Ball Aerospace. Agility to innovate, strength to deliver. Visit them at ballaerospace.com. That's ballaerospace.com. The Microsoft Cloud for Government.
The Justice Department, through CIO Joe Klimovitz, is making its move to shared services and even published the first version of its services catalog last year. According to Federal News Radio, Klimovitz said shared services should be the de facto way the Justice Department delivers IT. He also said service providers are not just DOJ entities and could come from other federal agencies or from industry. With nine separate systems across the Justice Department, email is a top candidate for shared services. This is Jason Fornicola.
The Microsoft Cloud for Government is the perfect match for federal government services. With tools like Microsoft Office 365, Microsoft Azure, and Dynamics CRM Online, discover how the Microsoft Cloud for Government provides cost savings, rigorous security located in U.S. data centers, and hybrid capability with an integrated open platform, all from one trusted source. Become familiar with the Microsoft Cloud for Government, and you'll be prepared to move toward the future today. Visit Microsoft.com/cloudforgovernment.
Please join AFSEA Washington, D.C. chapter on April 2nd for the 6th Annual Cybersecurity Technology Summit. Keynote speakers will feature NSA Director Admiral Michael S. Rogers and DHS Deputy Undersecretary for Cybersecurity Phyllis Schneck. Register today to hear senior military officers and government cyber leaders address challenges and strategies for mitigating tomorrow's evolving cyber threat environment. For more information, visit dcafseachapters.org.
Federal News Radio's Tom Temin is on Twitter. Follow him at ttemin_wfed for quick access to his latest interviews on the Federal Drive.
Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here and talking with Andy Medici, senior writer with Federal Times. Andy, with us?
It's always good to be here,
hey,
Mike.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for coming. A lot of stuff to talk about today. You had an interview with the new Postmaster General.
Yeah, that's correct. Megan Brennan, she's the 74th Postmaster General and the first woman to hold that office, actually.
And she's a career employee, too, isn't she? Up from the ranks?
Yeah, 30 years. She was previously the chief operating officer, but she began as a mail carrier in Pottsville, Pennsylvania.
It's so interesting that in the past, in the old days of the Post Office Department, that was always a very highly charged political job, and now it's not so much. And the last two, I believe her predecessor was a career guy as well.
That's correct. Patrick Donahoe also, you know, rose through the ranks, and that's something that Megan Brennan brings to the table as well, as she, you know, takes charge and decides what the future of the Postal Service should be.
Well, what did you report about? What did you talk about?
Well, she still wants comprehensive postal legislation, and that's something that, you know, her predecessors have been working on for years, ever since the last one in 2006. But she said that she wants to work more towards, at least at first, compromise legislation that involves perhaps the pre-funding of retiree health benefits that is really hamstringing things over at the Postal Service, as well as perhaps even making their own Postal Service health plan that integrates with Medicare and makes Medicare the primary insurance for postal employees.
Well, you know, the idea of that forcing them to pre-fund their retirement, now, am I correct that that's the only federal agency that's required to do that?
At least 100%. You know, there have been mentions in the past of small partial percents, but the idea that they have to pre-fund to that extent is definitely unique among federal agencies.
Well, you know, something else you've been working on, which fascinates me, is the fact that a number of federal workers now are suing the government because they were paid late during the last shutdown.
That's correct. The idea here is that did the government violate the Federal Labor Relations Act by withholding a paycheck and causing financial hardship to federal employees? And judges have so far been letting the lawsuit go forward, saying that it is indeed a violation, that even though the government is unable to make those payments during a period of shutdown, the one that was in October in 2013, that doesn't waive their legal obligation to pay workers. So federal employees who were deemed essential and had to work during that time, they will be eligible to participate. The damages, the attorneys for the plaintiffs are asking for about $290 per federal employee. And, you know, any federal employee who had to work during that time and wasn't paid, they will be getting notices in the mail from the Justice Department asking if they want to participate.
$290 is not all that much money, but when you multiply it by a million plus people, then you're talking real change there.
It's a lot of money, and I think also for a lot of federal employees who want to at least make a statement that, you know, shutdowns are not a good idea and that they shouldn't happen. You know, a lot of federal employees took a lot of these complaints to, you know, MSPB and others, and so far haven't had much success there. But, you know, maybe for federal employees who feel like, you know, they want to send a message, this might be the way to do it.
Well, I remember years ago when they didn't have shutdowns as often as of late, but they did have them. And the argument was that this is, in effect, this is slavery. This is the government saying you must show up for work, but you're not going to get paid. Now, they're winking and nod, you'll be paid eventually, but you won't be paid on time. And people said this is just flat out wrong and illegal. And then it seemed to lie dormant for years. Do you know what triggered it this time around?
I think just a lot of federal employees, this was the length of the shutdown, maybe wasn't as long as the one in the 90s, but you're right, it doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it's massively disruptive. And I think federal employees, just enough of them got together with the right attorneys and found an argument that works, because federal government is unique as an employer, and so it's not beholden to certain restrictions, and it can do a lot under, for example, national security, forcing people to, you know, staff the borders and the airports. But where they ran afoul is a law that says that you can't short people and pay them less than minimum wage. And so for that one pay period where federal workers worked for 2 weeks but only got paid for one, they got paid less than minimum wage. A lot of them did. And so that was that's the loophole that's allowed this lawsuit to go forward. So I think in this case, it was finding the right door to open to make this conversation, as opposed to sort of the larger arguments about working for free during this time.
I wondered if there was any politics behind it. That is, if, you know, I always like to change names or reverse things. If this had been President Bush instead of President Obama, would the same group of people have made this lawsuit?
You know, that's a hard one, you know, because you're right. There haven't been that many mm-hmm. shutdowns, and it's hard to draw a pattern. But what I do know is that any settlement that they get from the government or any judgment that they get from the government is going to also have to go through Congress, and that's where we're really going to see if it mm-hmm. breaks down on partisan lines.
Yeah. Well, and during the Bill Clinton administration, it was probably the longest shutdown. It stretched over a lengthy period of time, and the Republicans lost the PR battle, but it was under a Democratic regime. So I just wondered if that would make a difference.
You know, I think time will tell, especially if Congress has to get involved. We'll kind of see how it shakes out, because right now there hasn't been a lot of comment from the top on what this lawsuit might mean.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I just wonder why now, because during the Depression and during World War II, you had a number of very wealthy people who came down, bankers from New York and experts in various things, and they came to work for the federal government, and they were known as dollar a year men because they signed a contract that they were to be paid $1 per year to work for the government, but that satisfied the compensation laws. And I just wonder why now.
Well, you know, compensation laws have changed over time. You know, as a why now, it's hard to say. You know, maybe there was just a certain level of frustration. You know, the shutdown was preceded by a couple years of pay freezes, you know, furlough notices, RIFs and stuff. And maybe the group of people were just fed up enough. Or maybe, you know, maybe we'll find out later that there were some politics behind it. But right now, I think it just happened to be the perfect storm, you know, of a lot of newer laws and a lot of new ways of looking at things.
Well, one of the lessons we're learning, and I guess we should have known this in our naivete, is that when Congress or the White House, whoever, when somebody shuts down the government, it's not to save money, because you force people, some are forced to come into work, others are forced to stay home, then you either wind up paying them, as you did during the shutdown, or not paying them, as you did during the furlough, in which case tens of thousands of people, furloughed and shut down people, went through the Merit Systems Protection Board, and presumably MSPB had to spend a lot of time, money, and effort to listen to those cases.
I think the thing to remember is that shutdowns are, you know, massively disruptive. So, you know, they don't save money, they don't save time, they put things behind everything from NASA programs to border protection to, you know, to farm programs. Those all get put on the back burner or they get stalled. So this is one of those situations where it's just yet another effect that we see from the shutdown. Even though the shutdown's, you know, more than a year and a half out, we're still seeing the effects, and we probably will for some time.
Well, and, you know, you kind of wonder, too, if, you know, when you have a fairly new Congress, the turnover is never very great in Congress, but it was larger than usual the last time around. So you get new people coming in, and all they know is that Washington is full of bureaucrats and people in green eye shades who need to be taught a lesson. And they see a shutdown as a good comeuppance. But in fact, they've never been through it, so they don't realize not only the disruption it causes at home, back in their home districts, but the actual costs of it.
And I think for a lot of people, it's really easy to think that this time it will be different, or this time it will, you know, maybe move for some sort of change. But all it really does is disrupt. And then when the dust clears and everything settles, it really is just federal employees and contractors and those communities that get hurt by this.
Andy, since you and I have been on the beat, and probably before you were born, one of the great fears that federal workers had was that their current retirement system, which is based on length of service and salary and their highest three-year average salary, that high three would be changed to the high five. And we've been through it every year. Somebody brings it up. It's part of a bill or some appropriation. It scares people. We get to write about it, report on it, and in the end, nothing happens. This year, some people think it may be different because it's been introduced as a standalone bill.
That's correct. You know, the legislation, it's really quite short. It all it does is change the base calculation from the highest three-year average to five-year average, the high five. And, you know, in terms of concern about whether it's a standalone bill or not, I think what federal employees need to look for is that over time, if there's any sort of larger budget compromise or any sort of large amalgamation of programs and stuff that Congress decides to pass, you know, can that get swept up in the mix? That's always a possibility. And that's how the last pension changes were done, is sort of part of a larger compromise bill involving a lot more budget. budget and tax issues than just federal employees. So I think it's good to look at those standalone bills, but I also think, you know, once it becomes part of that negotiation mix, I think that's where the real danger is.
Right. Well, the retirement package is always a target, and it's always fair game for politicians. But in point of fact, as you say, there haven't been any significant changes to it in years. The creation of FERS out of the CSRS system, and then you have new hires paying a little bit more. But the only change that's happened in the last 20 or 30 years is they went from the high five to the high three. So now they, you know, people forget that it used to be the high five as it is in many private companies. Has anybody figured out how much the typical Fed would lose going from a high three to a high five?
See, that's a tough one because we've also had several years of pay freezes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a lot of federal employees, I think, are looking at that with some anxiety as well. They would probably, you know, if you amortize it over time and over the course of retirement, it's going to be a good chunk of money, even if it doesn't seem like some up front. And, you know, as your guests have said before, it's about the long term and about 30 years of retirement. And if you add up a small decrease or, you know, a small change in your five-year average over your three-year average over time, that's going to add up to real money.
Well, in the legislation, and I'm not clear on the number, but it seems to me they said it would save billions, X billion dollars over a 10-year period. And if you could figure out how many federal workers there were and break it down that way, you could get a whatever the estimate is of the, quote, savings to the government, which would be a cost to the retirees, to an individual retiree.
Well, ultimately that and you're right, that would be a pretty significant amount of money overall.
Okay. Excuse me, they're giving us a signal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Talk to you next week. Thank you, Lauren Larson. See you all here next Wednesday. Have a good week.